Last night, mostly while in bed, I had the chance to read an interesting book. It's called Your Inner Fish, A Journey into the 3.5 Billion Year History of the Human Body. The author is Neil Shubin. Neil is a professor, one of the world's leading paleontologists. He's a professor of anatomy and associate dean of the medical school at the University of Chicago, provost of the Field Museum of Natural History. And he is the author of the book, Your Inner Fish. And it's, I think, a great day to have him on. Neil will be in Madison, as a matter of fact, on Friday to speak as part of the Darwin Days celebration that occurs in Madison, Milwaukee, and Whitewater. Well, he'll be in Madison on Saturday to speak. And his topic is discovering how fish evolved to walk, the story of Tiktaalik. And I think he's with us. Neil, are you
there? Yeah, I'm here. Thanks.
thanks a lot for being with us today to talk with us about your book and maybe a little bit about Charles Darwin as well.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Was Charles Darwin your inspiration?
One of them. In fact, it's one of those things that's a continual inspiration. I just find it remarkable when I go back to read the book just how much it formed a framework for what I do today, you know, over 100 years after he got to work. It's just a remarkably successful scientific theory idea. And each time I read the book, it just hits me again and again.
Yeah, it's a fascinating book. And I have to say, your book is fascinating as well. You lead quite an interesting life.
Well, I teach in a medical school as a paleontologist, so that disconnect right there led to the birth of the book, to be quite honest.
Yeah, I was really interested in reading that part about how you actually became interested. Tell that story, because I think that's an interesting story.
Sure. Well, I moved to the University of Chicago in 2001, and actually moved in as chairman of the anatomy department in the medical school. And it's not unusual to have paleontologists like myself in an anatomy department, and actually teaching human anatomy to the first-year medical students. But I got pulled into this because we had a number of faculty leave our department for a number of reasons, retirements and other sorts of things.
They left.
Exactly. And so I was now all of a sudden pressed into service to teach the most important course in the first-year medical student curriculum, which is the cadaver-based human anatomy course, you know, where you basically look at the structure of the human body. And I remember, my first weeks in the course, students would come up to me and they'd say, you know, Dr. Shubin, what kind of doctor are you? You know, they're thinking, thoracic surgeon, gastroenterologist. And I said, well, you know, I'm a fish paleontologist. And that sort of disconnect was striking to them at first. But the beauty of the whole thing and the intellectual power of it was that being a fish paleontologist is an enormous advantage in teaching human anatomy. Because the basic roadmaps to our own bodies, whether it's the nerves in our heads, the structure of the bones in our heads, our backs, and our limbs, are seen in fish. And they're seen in living adult fish, but they're also seen in embryos of fish and the fossils of fish, which is sort of my specialty. And then teaching the course, in the summer of one of those years, we found this creature, Tiktaalik, which is a sort of an intermediate between fish that lived in water and the creatures that evolved to walk on land.
So it's Tiktaalik.
Yeah.
Oh, here and I.
Well, there's a couple pronunciations, actually. So it's a Western Arctic term, and there's Tiktaalik, Tiktaalik. We did Tiktaalik, whatever.
Tiktaalik is the one that you use, however.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so... How does Tiktaalik or Tiktaalik figure in all of this?
Well, it's really remarkable because we went to the Canadian Arctic to the 600 miles south of the North Pole, based on a prediction from the work of Charles Darwin, actually 100 years before, the idea that we should find intermediates in the fossil record if we look at rocks of the right age. So my colleagues and I, Ted Deschler's in Philadelphia, Farish Jenkins in Boston, we got together and we devised a plan. Let's go up there, and we had rocks of the right age, about 375 million years old, and find something that could tell us about the transition. It took us about 6 years to do it, but we found this creature. And what it is, if I was to lay it in front of you, what you would see, you'd immediately say, well, it's kind of a fish. You know, you'd see scales on its back, and you'd see fin webbing, okay? But then there'd be a little disconnect. Fish don't have necks. But this creature has a neck where the head is separate from the body and it can move independently. It has a flat head with eyes on top, much like early land living animals. And importantly, when you look inside that fin webbing, what you find are bones that correspond to our upper arm, forearm, even parts of our wrist and palm. What you have in Tiktaalik is a fish that has very primitive features of land-living animals. It's just a wonderful visual example of the beauty of evolution, of the transitions that we see when we look at the fossil record. So the way this relates to humans is interesting, because when we look at the origin of a neck in a creature like Tiktaalik, we're not just dealing with some random neck. We're dealing with a piece of our own evolutionary past. That's the origin of something that became our own neck. When we deal with the origin of a wrist that we see in a creature like Tiktaalik, that's something that became our own wrist. So the beautiful story of something like Tiktaalik, and indeed for the whole transition from life in water to life in land, is that this is not just some random event that we shouldn't care about. This is an ancient event that is a deep part of our own past and is captured inside our own bodies. And that to me was the beauty of the whole thing.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I want to give people a chance to join in. I haven't given the number yet, so let me do that. If you have some questions for our guest today, Professor Neil Shubin, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or in the Madison area, you can reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Email us at talk@wpr.org. We'll get you on that way as well. Neil is the author of the book Your Inner Fish, and it's just out, doing pretty well.
That's what they tell me.
That's what I hear.
It's in its third printing, which is
that's amazing. So this you do a nice job in the book. One of the nice things is I'm not a great scientist, and by any means at all. But I enjoyed reading the book. It's very readable. And maybe you could talk just briefly about how you've got the book organized and a bit about the book.
Sure. What I wanted to do in the book is really sort of take apart the human body, tell the story of the human body through the bodies, the fossils, and the DNA of everything from fish to worms to jellyfish. That is, it's the idea that captured in every organ, in every cell, in every piece of DNA in our bodies is about 3.5 billion years of the history of life on this planet. And I wanted to tell that story. So what I do in the book is I go sort of through a system-by-system tour of our bodies, showing how, you know, modern science uses fossils, uses DNA, uses embryos. We use many different lines of scientific inquiry, of approaches, to answer questions about diversity, and in this case, it helps us understand our own body. In terms of writing the style of the book, you know, actually, my father's a non-scientist, and he's always, you know, for years wondered, you know, why I do what I do. So he was the perfect audience in my brain when I wrote the book. Actually, that's true. I really, you know, much of this was as I wrote it, as I was at the screen, I realized, typing away, that it was almost like a monologue to my dad, you know, sort of describing it in layman's terms. But in a way, I wanted to get a couple things across, you know, not just the facts of what we do, but that we discover this. This is not stuff we find in textbooks. You know, we go out in the field to find things, to find new fossils. Colleagues, and including some people in my lab, work on DNA and other things. So these are discoveries. So I wanted to capture the sense of discovery about this.
Yeah.
And also the third thing is that we scientists, love what we do typically. I enjoy most days going to work, mm-hmm. and that's true with most of my colleagues. So I wanted to capture a sense that, hey, you know, this stuff is really fun. I mean, there's a joy of doing this. And so that's sort of what the spirit was as I sort of sat down to write it.
Well, Tiktaalik and worms and jellyfish, you know, most people have a little trouble figuring out what has a worm got to do with me, or what does a jellyfish or a Tiktaalik have to do with me?
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. I mean, so if you look at the structure of our own body, you can see it written in a very simpler form in the structure of fish. When you look at the DNA recipe that builds our bodies, you can go back even further. You can find versions of it in relatives of living jellyfish, even creatures like sponges. And so it's really a remarkable story. And in fact, you can really see this if you look at the Nobel Prizes in medicine or physiology over the last, 13 years or so. I mean, judging by those things, I should have called the book Your Inner Yeast or Your Inner Worm. Because, I mean, just take the last few years, two Nobel Prizes in medicine or physiology have gone to five scientists working on a little worm the size of a comma on a piece of paper that lives in the dirt. That little worm is unlocking secrets to tell us about how our DNA works, which ultimately is actually going to have a major impact on human health. You know, I cannot imagine a better statement about how, you know, our inner worm is important to us than just looking at, the work on how that little worm will impact our health in the coming years.
That was one of the fascinating parts of the book for me, and I do want to get into that as we go along here, but we have lots of callers online. I want to give them a chance to join in, Neil, so let's do that. Karen and Amory, we'll give you a chance first. Hi, Karen.
Hi. We in Wisconsin are fishing people, and we'd like to believe that they don't feel pain when we catch and release. What do you think?
Good question. I'm a fisherman as well, catch and release, fly fisherman, and I would like to believe the same thing. But, you know, there are studies of both sides. I would tend to think that at least in the oral area, they do not feel have the same sensations we do, just judging by the main, you know, the branches of the main sensory nerve, the cranial nerve that controls that. But I don't know for sure, to be quite honest.
All right. Thanks for calling. Yeah, I'm a big fisherman, too. Musky fishing is sort of mine. They're pretty high on the fish chain as far as I'm concerned. Bill, thanks, Karen. Bill in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, as I am following the logic and the argument, ostensibly, originally, everything was a fish, and then it sprouted legs and crawled up on land and became a mammal and evolved from there. If that's the case, since all living things were killed when the dinosaurs died off, then there's no link to us back to those original fishes. Secondly, if those original fishes crawled out on land and evolved into other mammals, they no longer exist, those original fishes I'm talking about. And therefore, I don't see how we could have evolved from them, but if we did evolve from them, then anything that evolved would be existent today. Therefore, how could man be evolved from apes if apes are still around today? If we evolved out of apes, then apes wouldn't be here anymore.
Yeah, your question gives me a chance to really answer some important misconceptions about evolution. And let me just to think about evolution as a family tree. If you think about a family tree, and let's just think about our own families, you know, just because I was born doesn't mean my dad had to die or that all my cousins have to disappear. That is, that the whole tree is a flowering bush, that you have different branches that can continue, others that die out. But just because a branch reflects something that's distantly related to me doesn't mean that it disappears. Apply that same analogy to, you know, the tree of life, and what you find is, well, it absolutely is a tree. It's not like a process where every individual of one form, call it fish, broadly speaking, gets transformed into amphibians and then into reptiles. It's a family tree with many branches and twigs, and in fact, we see that today. Here's the beautiful thing, is you can see aspects of our own family tree even in fish. Go to Africa, go to South America, go to parts of Australia, and what you'll find are lungfish, which are relatives of Tiktaalik, living ones, very distantly related to Tiktaalik, but they have lungs, they have gills, they have a bone that corresponds to our upper arm bone. Their cranial nerve pattern is very similar to ours in some key ways. So anyway, it's important to think of this as a transformation of a whole batch of one things into another whole batch of other things. Think of it as a family tree, because that's actually how evolution works, and that's what we see when we look at DNA and fossils and so forth.
A follow-up question.
Sure.
If man evolved from apes, what did elephants evolve from? Butterflies?
No, elephants, and I assume you're being facetious there, but the elephants actually evolved. You can see that kind of gradually, the gradual evolution in mammals. Evolution in mammals basically went very gradually, where you have a form of creature. Some of these are aquatic, some of these are terrestrial creatures of about 15 to 25 million years ago that gradually evolved into elephants. It's a beautiful series, and you can see it written actually. What's beautiful here is you can see these things written not just in DNA, not just in fossils, but also in the DNA of living creatures. That is, we have two wonderful records that for all the world look independent, but are only joined if there is evolution that existed as a family tree.
Interesting. Thank you very much for calling, Bill. Neil Shubin, our guest today, author of the book Your Inner Fish, as we talk about his book and a little bit about Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin's life is being celebrated annually through Darwin Day events, and we'll talk about some of those events, one of them in which Neil Shubin is actually participating. Coming up next year, I'm Larry Mueller. Cheryl Gasser, our on-air producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Happy to have you listening in here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking with Neil Shubin, who is a professor of anatomy and associate dean of the medical school at the University of Chicago, provost of the Field Museum of Natural History, and is the author of the book Your Inner Fish. And certainly as we talk with him about his book, about fish and about jellyfish and worms and everything else, and I hope you'll join in with your questions and with your comments. And you can do that at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. We've got some open lines. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Let's go to David in Ironwood, Michigan next. David, hi. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call.
Yeah, I have a couple points. But to answer that guy who just called earlier who seems to not believe in evolution, I mean, easy way to kind of make God and evolution go together is just that God controlled the random chance of the genes mutating. For them to say that evolution dismissed God is sort of like saying God has no control over random chance, which sort of diminishes it. But getting back to what I originally called, I read an article in February's issue of Scientific American about microchimerism, essentially saying that cells from the mother cross over the placenta and goes to the fetus, and these can survive for decades inside of people, what I call it. And I'm wondering how that might affect evolution. It's kind of interesting, a very interesting article if you want to read it. Then I also saw a show on Nova how this one family in Turkey walked on all fours because of a genetic defect. Then they used that to help trace down genes that involved walking. The whole concept of using different genetic diseases to try to ferret out what genes do, I found quite interesting.
Comments, Neil?
Yeah, I mean, I think the notion of using genetic diseases to trace evolution actually has a couple of points there. I mean, one is really we use a study of mutants or genetic diseases, if you will, to really understand how genes work. You know, what we're after here in understanding of evolution is to try to get to the bottom of, you know, what's the recipe written in DNA that builds bodies? And, you know, if we can begin to sort of outline the framework of what that recipe is, then we can ask the question, which is very profound, is how does the recipe that builds an organ or a body of a human different from the recipe that builds the organ or a body of a chimpanzee, you know, other mammals, fish, and worms, and so forth? Because there we're getting to the bottom of, you know, how has evolution worked to produce the differences that we see. What's really remarkable here is when you begin to do that, what you find is dramatic similarities in the various recipes or versions of the recipes that build bodies of creatures as different as humans and even flies. And, you know, worms and jellyfish and sponges and so forth, versions of the same genes, are there doing somewhat similar or sometimes analogous kinds of things. So it's a really remarkable story.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's go to Rex and Spencer, I think, is next. Rex, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning to both of you.
Yes, good morning.
I have a little different way of interpreting the information that your guest is giving there. I think there's another way of looking at this in that, you know, he's talking about the commonalities of all these different creatures.
Yes.
And I would view that more as a commonality than coming from the Creator himself, and I myself being a six-day creationist believer.
Okay, let me answer that for one second. The beauty of Darwin's theory as a scientific theory is that it allows us to make testable predictions. And I mean that in two ways. One is my colleagues and I can use that to make predictions, to actually go to rocks somewhere out in the far reaches of the Earth and find intermediates in the fossil record. So the scientific framework we have is beautiful in that it allows me to actually make predictions about things we haven't found yet, to venture into the unknown. The other piece of this, which is really important, is that that framework is also testable itself, that it's falsifiable. And in fact, with every fossil, with every piece of DNA that we look at, we are able to test the whole theory of evolution. Let me give you an example. I could have disproved evolution with a simple discovery, and that is, if I went up to rocks 375 million years old, to the beds that Tiktaalik is preserved in, and I was finding Tiktaaliks, and I found a human skull sitting there, that would be, to most scientists, a major challenge to what we understand about the geological record and what we understand about evolution. So, you know, so what I'm getting at here is scientific knowing, the way that I apply, allows me to make predictions and to make falsifiable predictions, the ones that I can, you know, show they're wrong or correct.
Thank you very much for calling. Edith in Madison, let's give you a chance. Hi, Edith.
Okay, good morning. There is a body of physics called thermodynamics, and there is a law within that body which states...
Yeah, second law of thermodynamics. People won Nobel Prizes to show that.
May I finish? It's called... The law states that something cannot come from nothing. So my question is, where did life come from?
You're betting two different things there. One is, when we talk about the second law of thermodynamics, we're dealing with a closed system, not an open system. And so the Earth is an open system where energy is continually being input by the sun.
Okay.
Is that supposed to explain it?
Well, that means that the second law of thermodynamics is completely consistent with evolutionary biology.
Where did the first molecule of life come from?
Well, that's a good question. Let's define what life is. I don't know. I wasn't there. But what you need here for a life form to evolve is three things. The first is you need some kind of molecule that can make a copy of itself. Now, we have lots of molecules out there that can make copies of themselves, various types of clays, various types of nucleic acids, various types of crystals. They can replicate themselves. What you need for an evolving life form is not just something that can make a copy of itself, but that can make a copy of itself with mistakes, that can, you know, have a mutation, if you will. The third piece of that is that sometimes those mistakes have to affect the ability of the thing to make copies of itself, you know, in terms of the rapidity of those copies. So what I'm getting at here is the definition of evolvable life, okay, which may have existed 303.6, 3.7 billion years ago, need not be something you'd recognize as an RNA or a DNA. It could be some small component of a molecule which is evolvable by natural selection. That is, it can make copies of itself. It could make copies of itself with mistakes, and some of those mistakes would affect the ability to copy. So that's entirely plausible. One can model this with the laws with physics and chemistry and see that this is entirely plausible. Process that one does not need to, you know, invoke a supernatural entity to explain that.
Where do you come up with 3 to 6 billion years ago?
Well, that's radiometric dating
from
and fossils, exactly. So, you know, what you have here are, you know, so the idea of the history of the Earth and the ancientness of the world we see around us is not just based on one line of reasoning. It's based on fossils, which exist in the rock record. It's based on the DNA alive in every, you know, creature on the planet today. And it's also based on the laws of physics and chemistry, which show us that we can use certain molecules, isotopes, with their clock-like properties and their rates of radiometric decay to assess the ages of rocks and around the world.
Thank you very much for calling, Edith. Appreciate your call. I want to give Mike and Appleton a chance, too. Mike, hi.
Yeah, hi. I have a comment, a question, and a request. I'll start with the request last, if I could have a follow-up. My comment is, I kind of go along with Darwin in the sense, you know, the theory of evolution, it kind of makes sense. But I would ask you a question. Do you believe in God?
Put it this way. To find Tiktaalik, to do the work I do, I don't need a God. Let's put it that way. My personal religious beliefs are my family's affair, but the work that I do in terms of the science, the ability to explain the history of the Earth, the ability to understand the diversity of life, the ability to make predictions and test them, I don't need a creator.
Okay. I can see that you must come up against that sort of a question all the time, and I understand. That's it. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. John in South Milwaukee, we'll go to you. Hi, John.
Hi. My question is more, it's a little different on the questioning of Darwin so much as explaining behaviors. Emperor penguins, you know, you saw March of the Penguins and stuff, where they go on and actually breed in the middle of the Arctic winter, in the middle of an ice. You know, how did this occur without just all the parents dying off one year because it was so cold?
Well, I mean, you can have, I mean, one thing you know is that incredibly complex things, whether it's a anatomical structure, whether it's a behavior, what have you, can evolve very rapidly by natural selection. And we know that from watching animals in the wild today, that what you can see is by people who track natural selection acting on, you know, populations of fish, actually manipulating fly populations using artificial selection, what you can see is that natural selection is capable of very, very, very rapid change. And any entity, whether it's a piece of a body, an anatomical system, or a behavior that actually has shows variation, that is genetically heritable, can evolve very rapidly. So while I don't know the exact story of how, you know, emperor penguins evolved their specific behavioral mechanisms, I do know that that kind of feature is something that could readily evolve by natural selection if there's genetic variation to produce it.
Okay.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. I want to, before we go much further, I also want to reiterate that you'll be speaking, Neil, in Madison at the University of Wisconsin Microbial Sciences Building on Saturday at 11, this coming Saturday in room 1220, the Ebeling Symposium Center. That's sponsored by the Department of Genetics and Botany and the Department of Biochemistry and I think Curriculum and Instruction, also Geology and Geophysics, so lots of departments taking part in that. And that's part of the Darwin Days celebration, and that event is free and open to the public. And you'll be kind of talking about your book, I assume, at that event.
Yeah, for the most part, we're talking about this discovery of Tiktaalik. How we predicted it, you know, how it conforms with Darwinian, you know, with ideas that Darwin promoted over 100 years ago. And then what we'll do is sort of show how that's a piece of our own past.
Yeah, so that should be interesting. And I do also want to mention Darwin Day. There's a Darwin Day event in Milwaukee, University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, at Lapham Hall on February 7th at 7 p.m., and another event in Whitewater, actually the 10th annual. They've been doing it longer than anyone else in the state. Their 10th annual Darwin Day is Tuesday, February 12th at the Hamilton Center. Dr. Michael Novacek of the American Museum of Natural History will be speaking at that event at 6:45 in the evening at Whitewater. Do you know Dr. Novacek?
I trained with him, actually, in New York. He was one of my mentors when I was an undergraduate working at the American Museum of Natural History. So it's a very small world.
Very small world. I'll tell you what, I want to give some others a chance to get on, but I also wanted to go back a little bit. I was fascinated by the part of your book near the end where, and you made some mention of it earlier, that a lot of our ailments, physical ailments or even some of our diseases kind of go back to the worms and the jellyfish and so forth that you talk about in the book.
Yeah, I mean, and this is just a wonderful case. If, you know, when you open up the human body, as we do in the human anatomy course, and look inside, what you find are vessels, nerves, muscles, tubes and ducts that take weird courses through the body. I mean, they don't go to a point from point A to B. They go from point A to 1, 2, 3, to 4, to 5, to 6, to B. You know, yeah. They take a weird course. And sometimes that causes problems in our bodies. I mean, for instance, being a human male, one of the problems we have is we have part of our abdominal wall is very weak, weaker than the female. And part of the reason for that is that the spermatic cord takes a weird loop in our bodies. Well, the only reason that the loops and turns that we see in our bodies take the odd courses that they do is because of history. I mean, if you look at if you compare ourselves to fish or to reptiles or to mammals, other mammals, what you'll find is that oftentimes to be a walking animal with a large brain and a complex control of our fingers, what you've had to do is tweak the design of a fish in sort of odd ways. Hence, you know, the nerves and arteries and vessels take these weird courses. And the spermatic cord in males is a beautiful example where we start development much like a fish, with males with the testes up towards the kidneys, higher up towards the chest, just like a shark.
Mm-hmm.
And they descend as we develop. They descend actually to enter the scrotum, which is a temperature control device. Well, that mammalness we have, that is, that's captured in the descent of the testes, actually creates a lot of problems. So this is a beautiful example of how our history comes back to bite us in significant ways.
Interesting. And you were talking about your own ails. I think you had a knee problems or something, and relating that in your book as well to our history.
Well, very much. Tiktaalik has a knee. I mean, there you have a fish found at the right time in the fossil record, 375 million years ago, that has, you know, shoulder, elbow, and wrist. It has a hip, knee, and ankle. And in fact, you know, fish of that age, actually the intermediates between life in water and life on land, actually had knees. But the problem is that knee wasn't designed to support an animal that walks on two legs like we do. And so what we have is a situation in humans where much of our weight is actually carried by our knees and ankles, and that sets them up for certain problems. And in fact, so regular are the injuries to portions of our knee that, you know, if you hurt your knee, you're going to, more often than not, is an injury, hurt one of three structures. You know, the anterior cruciate ligament, the medial meniscus, the medial collateral ligament. Those are three weak spots that are there that fail in very predictable ways. And largely that's because of a past that was not as an animal that walks on two legs. We were first fish swimming with fins, and later we were animals that walked on four legs, and now we're an animal that walks on two.
Brian in Duluth, Minnesota, we'll give you a chance now. Brian, hello to you.
Hi, Professor Shubin. My question involved I had a question about the sarcopterygian or lobe-finned fish,
sure,
as they're commonly called. I was wondering, you know, in the older textbooks, they always, the theory for how fish evolved into tetrapods was that the fish were crawled onto land and using their fins to haul themselves out. And now, since then, that theory has been disproven. It's now known that the fish developed their limbs in the water to help them clamber around. But what I was wondering was, do they still think certain lobe-finned or sarcopterygian fish could move around on land using their fins?
Tiktaalik is a good example of a sarcopterygian fish. And all these sarcopterygian fish we're talking about, they're called lobe-finned fishes for a reason. They have a lobe in a fleshy lobe in the fin. They also have lungs. And so what you have is a creature in these cases that can live in sort of shallow water or even in the case of Tiktaalik, sort of in that interface between water and land. So what you're seeing in a creature like Tiktaalik and in some sarcopterygians of that time period are creatures that are adapting for, you know, sort of this shallow water, life on the water bottom, life on the mud flats sort of existence. You absolutely do see that in sarcops. In living sarcopterygians like lungfish, more often than not, you don't see that. You see creatures that are actually living on the bottom of the water, and they use their lungs to breathe when the water becomes depleted in oxygen.
Hmm. Interesting. Thanks, Brian. Appreciate the call. And let's see. Let's go to Kevin in Madison next. Kevin, hi to you.
Hello. I thought this was very interesting because so much has been talking about sea creatures moving into land. I live in Egypt for most of the year, and I've had a chance to go to a place, what we call the Valley of the Whales, which is in the middle of the Western Desert. And there's an animal that's called Bacillosaurus, which is sort of an intermediate species of when whales were going from land to sea creatures. And it's interesting seeing, because along with the skeletons that you see just laying on the top of the desert, you also have little shark's teeth all around the desert floor as well. And it just kind of points out what you're saying.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful example about how, you know, we humans have these categories, life in water and life on land. Well, nature does its own thing. You find that shift from water to land and from land to water back again many times, not just in mammals, but also in reptiles that, you know, evolved to return to the water. But we also see many kinds of fish that are evolving to walk on land, not just the sarcopterygians, which a previous caller referred to. We find other kinds of fish, like mudskippers, which can live for 24 hours on the mudflats. We find modern living fish that can climb trees. So it's really remarkable the diversity of the tree of life that we see and the remarkable things that these animals can do.
Yeah. Thanks, Kevin, for calling. Appreciate your call. And you note in the beginning of your book and then again at the end of your book, you take us on a little tour of the zoo and tell us to take a look at the zoo when we visit and look at it in a different way. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, one of the really profound things you can see about the natural world, you see in your own family. That is, we are similar but different to our parents. Our parents are similar but different to their parents. That is, there's a structure, you know, when you look at a family tree, there's a structure you can see to a family tree. And in fact, that same structure you see in our own family trees, you see when you walk through the zoo. That is, there are certain features that every animal in that zoo shares, such as every animal in that zoo has DNA and two eyes. But then you find there are more special and more special animals as you go through that. The central idea is the same tools that we use to identify our family histories, like through forensic DNA technology and other technologies, we can use to understand the family tree we see as we walk through a zoo. So it's the same thing. It's one's the family tree of our own human relatives, but those same techniques can be applied to show us the family tree of our animal relatives.
And as you talked about looking at the bear, and I forget the turtle.
You're right. Well, you begin to see, you know, what we share very deeply with other animals. And what's remarkable there is you can see the similarities you share with bears or with turtles or with other kinds of creatures, but then you can actually go in the fossil record and show how the gaps, oftentimes the gaps that you see that separate us from them, can be filled if you look at rocks of the right age. And we make predictions as paleontologists, like we make predictions like that all the time.
Neil, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
You.
Yeah, so thank you so much for being with us today. Neil Shubin is one of the world's leading paleontologists. He's a professor of anatomy and associate dean of the medical school at the University of Chicago and provost of the Field Museum of Natural History, and is the author of the book, Your Inner Fish. And he will be speaking again, as I said, Saturday, February 9th at 11 a.m. in the new Microbial Sciences Building. It's a beautiful building. It's worth a trip to see it, room 1220. In the Ebling Symposium Center. So that's 11 o'clock on the 9th. And I also wanted to mention again, Whitewater's 10th Annual Darwin Day is Tuesday, February 12th at 6:45 at the Hamilton Center. Dr. Michael Novacek of the American Museum of Natural History will be speaking. And February 7th, so just coming up on Thursday, Milwaukee's Darwin Day is going to be held at Lapham Hall on North Maryland Avenue, and some nice events and things scheduled for that Darwin Day event as well. Well, we've been talking a little bit about fish here, quite a bit about fish, actually. Another guy who swims with the fishes a lot is Dr. Robert Ballard of Mystic, Connecticut. He's one of the world's foremost oceanographers and discoverer of the wreckage of the legendary Titanic, among other things. We'll be talking with him coming up next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.